According to the basic law of Israel, elections for the Knesset, the parliament, must be universal, nationwide, secret, equal, direct, and proportional. And then the natural order of things, elections in Israel are also, and this is not by direction of the law, enthusiastic, expensive, and confusing. Israel is, as you know, a parliamentary democracy. This means that the voters elect the parliament, and that party or that coalition of parties which has a workable majority in the parliament forms a cabinet and occupies, according to certain formulae which they work out, the various ministries. The Israeli system is in many ways similar to the English. But there are basic differences. In the English system, elections are by district. In Israel, they are nationwide. In England, generally, a single party has a sufficient majority after a general election to form a cabinet, which is consistent in its ideology, which represents a single party. In Israel, with the exception of the very few first years of statehood, no party has had a sufficient majority in the Knesset to form a single party cabinet. There has always been a coalition, the necessity of hard head-to-head negotiations between those parties which will be in the coalition. In England, a minister must be an elected member of the House of Commons or the House of Lords. In Israel, a minister may be nominated to the cabinet who is not an elected official, because he has skills, or he has friendships, or he can perform certain responsibilities that the cabinet or the prime minister wish him or her to perform. In the event, elections to the Knesset are crucial. They determine who shall rule in Israel. But the Knesset itself is a relatively impotent body. Almost all authority is given over to the ministries, to the cabinet, and the critical debates take place within the cabinet itself, whether or not a particular group within the coalition will walk out of the coalition, which would bring down the government. And so debate in the Knesset tends to be formal, desultory, few are in attendance, and the very often very bitter clashes of opinion within the cabinet, those no one sees because the cabinet meets obviously in private. Now when the Israelis go to the polls, as they did the last day of 1973, they don't simply have an election night. They have an election week before all the results are known. It's a very complicated system. Since everyone is elected nationwide, rather than in a head-to-head confrontation with other candidates in a particular district, one is not elected ad personam as an individual, but as a member of a list. Every party prepares a list. The list includes a number of candidates, numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on, whom the party wishes to put before the electorate. and the party gains that number of seats in the Knesset which its vote qualifies it to gain. The major parties, of course, the labor alignment, the very basic labor group, the Mapai and the Mapam, who have in one way or another ruled Israel since its beginnings. The other major party in Israel is the Likud, the Unity Party, which is a combination of the old revisionists and of the General Zionists, a non-socialist, territorialist group. There were 21 lists submitted in the December election. There were 1,056 candidates for the 120 seats in the Knesset. How does Israel go about counting its votes? Well, the first thing that the Israelis need to know is how many people, in fact, voted. In Israel, you don't have that phenomenon that you have here in America, that by 7:30 or 8 o'clock on election night, the computer gives you already the probable victors in all the elections based on 2% of the samplings in a given state. Because the vote is proportional, and the vote is nationwide, and the vote is confusing. You first must know how many voted. And then you subtract from that total, which it may take you several days to arrive at if the army is mobilized in the field before all the ballot boxes are brought back from this tank corps and that radar station. You must subtract from that total the total of any party which did not receive at least 1% of the vote. For such a party does not qualify for a seat in the Knesset. Having made that subtraction of the total vote of those who didn't receive at least 1% from the total vote, you have a new figure. And what you do in Israel is to divide 120, the number of seats in the Knesset, into this new figure, and that will give you the mandate, the total number of votes which a seat in the Knesset requires. It was about 12,700 and a few seats for each mandate in this new Knesset. And then you take each party's vote and you divide it by 12,700 and a few, and you find out the number of seats that they are qualified for. But every such division is going to give you a remainder. And when you divide for the 13 lists who qualified for seating in the parliament into by their vote by 12,700, you find you've only qualified maybe 111 or 112 of the seats. Then you have to take the number of seats left over, look at each of the parties and determine who had the largest number of votes but didn't quite qualify for a seat, and these qualify for the 112th, 113th, 114th seats, up to 120 in descending order. It took 9 days after the December 31 election for Israel to know exactly who had been qualified for the new Knesset. Does it sound confusing? It is. Now, every form of government has its advantages and its disadvantages, its pluses and minuses. The Israeli system is open. Unlike the American system, where there are two major parties and it's almost impossible for a third party to emerge, in Israel there were 21 parties submitting lists at the last election. To submit a list, what you need to do is to have 5,000 Israeli pounds and a few thousand signatures. It's rather easy to qualify for a list. So it's open and flexible. It's nationwide, and that's been very fortunate. That means that this small country elects everyone from the total constituency. And though there are obviously people who've been elected by Druze groups or Arab groups or other special interest groups, everyone, in a sense, has a seat at large. And in that small country, that you have avoided what would otherwise have happened, and that every man represents his own little medina, his own little province, and voting in the Knesset would have been a matter of impossible log rolling. You can't imagine a pork barrel bill in Israel, and that they managed to avoid by this kind of system. In addition, for better or for worse, this kind of election avoids the cult of personality. You're not elected simply because you're good-looking and young and have charisma or sex appeal, but because you have won for yourself within the party a right to a seat, a number high up on the list that your party is submitting. Now, the minuses in this system must also be recognized. And they are, in a sense, the reverse of its advantages. The major negative, as far as the system is concerned, is it really does not allow politics to become an attractive undertaking for the brightest and the best. To qualify in the main parties, you have to play the party game. You have to have taken your time. You have to have said yes to the elders. You can't push yourself forward too brashly. You have to agree to many who are perhaps inferior to you in ability or in appeal, the party hacks, the apparatchiks. Now, why don't you simply go out and create a new party? Because in Israel, which is a heavily bureaucratic state, there are only several parties that really count. And if you break with one of these major parties, unless you represent some extreme group whom the parties really don't worry about, the Black Panthers, a kind of radical group who try to represent the Oriental Jews, Meir Kahane trying to represent an extreme kind of mulishness in international affairs, you find that the whole apparatus of the society swings against you. You're no longer able to cut through red tape to do in your business or in your farming or whatever you do what needs to be done. Israel is not a flexible social order. Things operate, the Israeli word is, by protexia, by how well you are respected, by whom you know. And if you break with one of the dominant parties, suddenly people know you too well. Suddenly it's very hard to accomplish what needs to be done. So it's very hard for a person of ability, aggressive, the kind of person who sometimes needs to achieve leadership, even in a democracy, to put himself forward. In Israel, you recognize that the only well-known figures come from two groups. Not from men who have won their spurs in politics, but either from the old line leaders who have around themselves the aura of being the founders of the state, Ben-Gurion, Sharet, Golda Meir, or from generals in the army, Moshe Dayan, Yigal Alon, the newest one, Arik Sharon. And it's not good, really, even when you have a citizen's army, for the only way for personality to emerge in the political realm through military leadership. But you can't, unless you know Israel very, very well, it's very hard to think of a politician who has emerged through the normal political channels because he simply appeals or his ideas appeal to the electorate. The result is that in the generation in their 40s, in their early 50s, in their late 30s today, you find very few men and women of great ability who have gone into politics, who have played the game. And the Israeli ministries are staffed and led often by people of quite unexceptional ability. And this lack of political leadership evidences itself again and again in Israel. Here's a young state who 5 years ago, when the previous Knesset was elected, had to call a 70-plus-year-old grandmother in to run the state as prime minister because there wasn't anyone else who was strong enough or enough of a power base to run it. And she's 5 years older today. And she's obviously going to be the new prime minister. Israel has not developed the ways in which new leadership can emerge and gain a mandate, authority, and really lead. There's a price to be paid for that failure. Now, I've gone into the mechanics of the Israeli political scene to a certain degree because I think you can't begin to understand what this past election meant and what it didn't mean without understanding what it could say and what it could not say, what it could express and what it could not express. What could I do if I were an Israeli voter as I faced the 21 lists? How could I express what I felt? Obviously, this last election, which had been delayed from October when it was originally scheduled because of the war, was in a sense a referendum on the policies which led to the war, a referendum on the leadership of those who had made certain mistakes in the first days of the war. And the critical issue was not so much the past as the present. What must Israel be prepared to do? What stance must it take vis-a-vis Geneva? Vis-a-vis all of the very complex negotiations which are the result of the war. Obviously, this election would focus on foreign political concerns. In the first instance, there was the lack of preparation, of mobilization in October. The Israeli intelligence, as we now know, had seen the concentration of Syrian tanks on their side of the Golan. It knew something of the preparations twice before, in the spring and in the summer, by the Egyptians for a cross-Suez attack. It knew that the capability was there. There were intelligence reports which suggested that this might be the time. But the government, Mrs. Meir, others, Moshe Dayan, for some reasons not yet clear, decided not to call a major national mobilization. They did not act intelligently on the intelligence which was given to them. Now, this may be hindsight. Certainly didn't act, obviously, out of any desire to undo the military situation. But nevertheless, they were obviously guilty of certain kinds of failures. And a society needs to transfer leadership from those in whom you have confidence, who prove themselves, from those in whom you have lost a certain amount of confidence. But perhaps more important was the kind of policy which had led up to the impasse of last summer. There was in Israel a policy which was identified with three people: Golda Meir, Moshe Dayan, and a minister by the name of Galili. And this policy was essentially a maximalist one. It said, yes, we are prepared to negotiate, but we want these negotiations to be direct, and essentially there will be no withdrawal, no movement on our part until all of the pieces of the puzzle are completely arranged, until we've been guaranteed defensible borders, until our sovereignty has been recognized and some kind of true peace has been established. And more than that, this policy line insisted, since this does not seem to be happening, we're going to take those measures which will begin to integrate economically and sociologically and demographically the West Bank and Gaza, as well as the parts of the Sinai and the Golan, into the Israeli economy and Israeli life. We will go ahead and we will establish Israeli presence, colonies, towns near Hebron, in the West Bank, in Gaza. We will go ahead and establish economic relationships between the people in Gaza and the people who live near them in Israel, as well as the West Bankers and Israel. Now, that's a policy line. It can be defended. But it obviously had led to the kind of stalemate which had led to Egypt's feeling that now was an appropriate time for military activity. And all this was essentially up as a referendum. Now, as the foreign press analyzed the Israeli election, the issues of foreign policy would be debated between the two major lists, that of the Labor Alignment, Mrs. Meir, Mr. Dayan, and that of the Likud, represented by the fiery oratory of Menachem Begin. The Likud is an essentially non-socialist party whose major thrust has been that there must be a maximal concern with the territories within which Israel occupies herself. The territory gives you a measure of security. These are the true defensible borders. They are an outgrowth of the old revisionists who in the 1930s and 40s demanded that the entire mandate of Palestine become Israel, not simply the partition state and the West Bank, but even Transjordan. They have cogent arguments, obviously. There are cogent arguments which can be made on their side. And the argument was and is in the foreign press that it is essentially this debate on maximal borders on the part of the Likud and some kind of new, more flexible policy, the new party line of the Labor government, which we've seen work out at Geneva so far and in the Kissinger shuttle agreement, which was arrived at last week, that this would be the major issue which would be before the Israelis. But this analysis neglects two facts. The first is that extreme positions in foreign policy are rarely those which can really easily be debated on. And secondly, that since the Labor government has been in power for 26 and a plus years, the real debates on foreign policy have taken place where the power is, within the Labor government itself. And the Israelis, citizens of a small country, know that. Menachem Begin represents a protest vote. It represents a maximalist position. But over the last 6 years, there have been bitter intra-cabinet debates between a Yigal Alon, who says we ought not to build new cities in the West Bank, and a Moshe Dayan, who said we can't wait any longer. Between the National Religious Party, who were part of this coalition, who say we must at Hebron have a Jewish presence because there was a terrible riot there in the 1920s which destroyed the yeshiva, and we must establish this as a Jewish center. And an Abba Iban, who said this is not the way to peace. If you want to say that you're prepared to negotiate, you must show that in fact you are prepared to negotiate. And the Israelis know that the real political debate, the effective one, has taken place within the Labor Party. But how do you cast a protest vote when the Labor list has as its number one candidate Mrs. Meir, as its number two candidate Yigal Alon, as its number three candidate Abba Iban, and as its number four candidate Moshe Dayan? How do you say, I follow the Meir-Dayan line or I follow the Alon-Iban line? It's absolutely impossible. And as a result, the Israelis, when they went to the poll, did not have the options which the foreign press assumed that they had. Yes, in the result, there was a protest vote that went to the Likud. As the Labor alignment lost from 57 seats to 51 seats, the Likud gained from 31 seats to 37 seats. The National Religious Party, the third major party, lost from 12 seats to 10 seats. Obviously, some of the Likud gain was a protest vote. But the real pressure in Israel, interestingly enough, was an attempt by many, particularly academics and intellectuals and writers and newspaper people within the Mapai, within the Labor alignment itself, to get rid of Moshe Dayan, who represents to them a kind of impulsive aggressiveness, the mystique of the inviolability of Israeli arms. And there was just simply no way to get at that particular philosophy within those who will control the new government. As a matter of fact, because of the confusion and the complexity of Israeli policy, the two groups in Israel who lost most in terms of prestige in the election, will emerge in the new cabinet more powerful than they've ever been before. Moshe Dayan was a subject of serious attack from within his own party. He no longer has the charisma of the Six-Day War and the victory behind him. There was a serious attempt to get rid of him, but he emerges as the strongest labor minister in this new government. Why? Because in the counting of numbers, the Labor Party's loss of vote to 51, plus to which you must add some Arab Labor Party affiliates who have always voted with the Labor alignment, for the first time in Israel's history, does not give the Labor alignment at least a bare majority in the new Knesset. They've lost that bare majority. They are below 60 in their total guaranteed vote. As a result, they cannot purge any element, even those few disciples, ardent disciples of Dayan, who many would like to see purged. Dayan is the swing here. If he leaves, there's no chance of the labor alignment forming the new government. And so he emerges stronger, and it is he who is sent by Mrs. Meir to Washington as a signal of this to confer with Kissinger and with the Defense Department just a week ago. Dayan is weaker, but he emerges stronger. And the National Religious Party is the strong central Orthodox bloc who lost from 12 seats to 10 seats. They too, strangely, emerge stronger. Since the creation of the state, in order to guarantee first unity and then some kind of majority control, the labor alignment has always brought the National Religious Party into the government. Now, it's not a question of doing so out of an interest in unity. Now they must do so in order to form the government. These 10 votes, they're not the 12 they once had, but these 10 votes are the difference between a cabinet and no cabinet. And so the National Religious Bloc has increased its demands even though it's lost voter confidence. It's now insisting on three things. In the first instance, on four portfolios, four ministries in the new cabinet rather than the earlier three. In the second instance, it's insisting that the cabinet be a cabinet of national unity, including some of the members of the Likud, rather than simply Labor and the National Religious Party. And in the third instance, it's insisting on certain revisions in the law of return. Let me explain these because they're important. The first is obviously simply a grab for power. But the second and third are rather complex. What the national religious parties are demanding by asking for a cabinet of national unity has to do with foreign policy. For the first 20 or so years of the state, they contented themselves with demanding that all of the issues of personal status, that is marriage, divorce, inheritance, the like, be done according to the law and be under the rabbinic courts. And this was granted to them. There was that anachronistic situation where a socialist, atheist government was giving to the religious group religious control of certain elements in the society. But be that as it may, in the last few years, they have decided that part of the Torah true policies which the government must follow is one which demands that everything that the Bible describes as Eretz Yisrael, as the land of Israel, in fact be within the borders which are ultimately negotiated. And they have come out to a position very close to that of the revisionists, of the Likud. And what they want is more support in the new cabinet for this position, to preclude the labor alignment, the Israeli government, from actually talking about in largest measure, the return to the borders of 1967. Now, it's an anomalous situation for many reasons, not the least of which is that as a rabbinic party, they are bound to a definition of Eretz Yisrael, which is in the Mishnah and the Talmud, which is not the broad Israel described in one or another place in the Bible, but as a rabbinic Israel, described by the Halakha, a crazy quilt Israel, an Israel which includes part of the Negev, but not all of it, which includes most of what is in Israel today, but not all of it. Caesarea, for instance, the great watering spot, is specifically excluded from the designation Eretz Yisrael because it was once, or it was during those times, the Roman capital. Parts of the Galilee are excluded from the halakhic definition of Eretz Yisrael, because these were entirely inhabited by non-Jews. It's an anomalous situation, but that's where they are, and they're demanding a cabinet of national unity. And their third demand is a demand to increase their control of the laws of personal status. They control everything that happens in Israel. Now they want to control even to a degree what happens outside of Israel. And what they want to do is to define the law of return so that a Jew will qualify for return under that law, for entrance into Israel and citizenship under Israel, only if he is a Jew, kahalacha, according to the law. That means born of a Jewish mother or converted to Judaism by an Orthodox Beit Din. But if a Jew has been converted, a person has been converted to Judaism in some other way, if I've converted them, or a conservative rabbi has converted them, they are not, in their eyes, a Jew kahalacha. And in order to increase this synagogue state purpose of theirs, they're using this political moment to try and achieve that end. Now, it's incredible, really, that at this moment in time when Israel is besieged and beleaguered, we've got so many enemies without, but fanatics have to create tensions within. But there it is. And this tells you something about the mood of Israel after the election. Everyone is still continuing to do many of the things he did before October without any real recognition of the new reality, of the uncertainty, of the tentativeness which exists since October. And what you've had all month long in Israel is not only the need to press on with very complex negotiations, but if you think the Kissinger negotiations between Egypt and Israel have been complex, you don't know Israel politics. I assure you that the attempt by Shimon Peres and the labor alignment to create a new cabinet have been infinitely more complex. They've been talking about perhaps holding another election. They've been trying to break the National Religious Party's demands down. They've been trying to find a way around it. They've been trying to satisfy those who would like to see Moshe Dayan leave. They've been trying to agree on some kind of conditional platform and policy. The election was held December 31st. This is the end of January. There's no new cabinet. And Shimon Peres, who has been charged with the arrangements of the new cabinet, suggested maybe 2 or 3 more weeks before one is established. In Israel, a Knesset is elected for 4 years and remains in office unless one of the parts in the coalition or people move against the policies of the ministries, particularly of the prime minister. It's hard to see how this particular government, however it's arranged, will last out the full 4 years of its elected mandate. For the simple reason, as I've tried to suggest to you this morning, that this election in December settled nothing. It came too soon after the war to be really a referendum on the new initiatives which Israel is taking in foreign affairs. It came too soon after the war for new personalities, a Churchill, a Kennedy, to emerge, who could, in a sense, galvanize the spirit of the people. The only person to emerge with any prominence out of this war and out of this whole period is a man by the name of Arik Sharon, a flamboyant, tough-talking, hard-living general, who was the man whose tanks led the crossing of the Suez and they created that bulge in Egypt which Israel held until they began pulling back this week. Now, Sharon also is no new figure. It's June when the Likud made up its list. After Menachem Begin, Sharon is number 2 on the list. He's a political general who's using his obvious military skills for obvious political purposes. But be that as it may, no one has come to the fore who somehow expresses in language and in his person the whole range of concerns and commitments which a new Israel, a post-October war Israel, must face. And it seems to me that there are two issues which such a man, such a group, must somehow express. The first is a new sense of domestic purpose, of national commitment. I don't mean the commitment to basic survival. I mean a commitment to a life of austerity and sacrifice, the likes of which Israel has not known the last 15 or 20 years. This war came near to bankrupting Israel. Many of the social services, many of the educational services, many of the medical services were not only disrupted by the needs of the emergency, but will not for a long time now have the funds with which to operate that they had before October. There's less. Yes, the Israelis have paid much higher taxes. Yes, there have been enforced defense bond issues taken from them. Yes, many of them have made tremendous personal sacrifices to serve and continue to do so. But the simple, bitter fact is that over the next number of years, the Israeli economy will not be able to produce an increase in the standard of living such as the Israelis became accustomed to over the last decade or so. Between 67 and 73, life in Israel became quite agreeable. One measure of that were the growing number of strikes as each group wanted its increased share of the larger pie. But now there's less and not more. And now it's not simply an emergency. The less will be the condition of life for a number of years. And someone, somewhere, is going to have to somehow in himself express that commitment to basic things, to the land, to community, to Amcha, the people, Israel, to survival, to decency, which was expressed in the early kibbutzim, which was expressed in the very hard early days of the Zionist experience. And that man has not yet, or woman, that man or woman has not yet come forward. And then, of course, there's the unresolved question of negotiations. What does Israel give up? And what does she get? How mulish should she be, and how flexible should she be? And that decision, of course, is one which confuses almost all Israelis, for it depends upon another question, an issue which really they cannot of themselves answer, to which no clear answer is available. And that is, what are the Arab intentions? Are the Arab intentions merely to return to 67 and then to make peace? Are the Arab intentions to return to the borders of 67 and then make a new war? In a poll which I saw recently, the Israelis were of two minds. 82% of those who were in this poll felt that the Arabs would never make peace with Israel. And at the same time, 40-some-odd percent in this poll indicated they felt that after their victories early in this war and their defeats late in the war, the sense of power and the recognition of Israel's power, there was, for the first time, the real possibility of serious negotiations with Egypt. Now, psychiatrists could explain how we hold in our minds both cold reality and warm hope. And obviously, that's where Israel is today. But she doesn't know. No one knows. The experts differ. In the academic community in Israel, in the community of the professional Arabists, of those who study Arab sociology, Arab public opinion, Arab policy, there are two schools. They go by the name of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, after two old schools of rabbis who, in the first century, the common era debated this and that and the other thing. The Jerusalem school, mostly associated with a man named Harkabi, believes that the Arabs are committed completely to the total destruction of the state of Israel. And that as long as this generation of Arabs is in the saddle, that commitment is resolute. Perhaps, he says, when a new generation will come into power, who were born after Israel was a state, who've only lived in a world in which there wasn't Israel, they'll come to admit the existence and legitimacy of the state. But until then, he said, there is no real negotiation. The question then is, how strong can we remain? How deterrent is our power? The Beit Hillel School, the peace school, is centered in Tel Aviv University. Its major professors are men named Peled and Shammai. And these two men argue that there is in the Arab world a growing concern, particularly in Egypt, with the domestic evolution of their own economy, concerned with the development and the usual values of the middle class, that enough opportunity must be given, enough flexibility must be shown to give these groups some authority in their own state so they can begin to temper the firebrands and the ideologues and the militarists who think only in terms of Israel's extirpation and erasure from society, from the world. Who knows? The issue is there. No final solution, obviously, can be made with any sense of certainty. Well, these two issues confront Israel after the election. To find a new sense of national purpose which will not depend on a higher standard of living, and to find a new foreign policy which will satisfy Israel's needs for defense and security, and at the same time allow, if it can be, the forces in and outside the Arab world who really would like to see the conditions stabilized to come into the ascendancy and to be able to be effective. And neither of these issues was touched, was really confronted in the last election. Where does Israel stand today? Confused? Convinced that borders are important, at the same time recognizing that the borders of 67 could not be maintained. Proud of its army, concerned by the politicization of its army, which many of them feel was the reason that the alarm bells were not sounded early enough in October, that too many political concerns and were involved in what should have been essentially a strategic or military decision. Facing a future which is, in terms of things, material, quite bleak. Needing to find encouragement, spiritual encouragement. One of the things which we find in our private correspondence with Israelis, which we hear in the Israeli press, which Israeli visitors tell us, is that we need to see the faces of other Jews. We need to feel we're not alone. We need to feel that we're not abandoned. We don't face this bleakness by ourselves. And that's understandable. But ultimately, any country, any community must, take hold of itself and find its own center, its own core, its own heart, its own soul. Leaders can only, in a sense, galvanize this process. And unfortunately, the election of December did not create the youthful leader, the warm leader, the encouraging leader, the clear-eyed leader who might be so useful to Israel in the next years. Unfortunately, the bureaucrats and the apparatchiks are still largely in the saddle. And unfortunately, many in Israel are acting as if life can go on exactly as it went on in the years between 67 and 73. What's for it then? I think Israel will quickly come to a realization of its needs. There's nothing esoteric in this analysis. There are many in Israel of sensitivity, of great ability, I think the university people are going to begin to realize that they can't simply sit aside, that they've got to get into politics and do it. I think the press in Israel is going to recognize that it must not only report the political machinations and infighting, but it must do something of a crusading nature to encourage the community. And I am convinced that there are men and women, many of them, who in local and national ways will begin to express themselves, that Israel will find the heart and the courage which she will so desperately need. I certainly hope and pray so. Amen.